Huge news, Wayfair shoppers. There's still time to shop Wayfair's Cyber Week sale. Thought the savings were over? Think again. Cyber Week, aka the holiday home stretch, is on now. Right now, get up to 70% off everything home and everything you need for the season ahead. Save on quality furniture for every room in the house. Essentials for the guest room, whether it's new bedding or a new mattress. Kitchen and dining must-haves for all your hosting needs. And seasonal home finds like throw pillows and decor. Or favorites that you'll use all year long. Plus, you can sit back and relax. With Wayfair's fast and easy shipping, everything home comes straight to your home. Just in time for the holidays. Yep, even the big stuff. Didn't get everything on your Black Friday list? We got you. There's no place like home for the holidays and no place like Wayfair for Cyber Week savings. Shop Wayfair's Cyber Week right now through December 7th and save up to 70% off at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Okay, let's unpack this. We are diving into a topic today that, well, it kind of defies basic intuition about global power. When you think about Russia, the immediate image is just immense scale.
Absolutely. Vast territory, huge natural resources, and on paper, a population of 144 million people. It's a giant.
But that image, potent as it is, seems really misleading now. Because for decades, Russia's sheer size has sort of obscured this profound underlying structural weakness.
That's exactly it. Despite that big population number, the central economic reality for Russia right now is, well, they're calling it a devastating personnel famine.
A personnel famine. That's the paradox we really need to get into. How can a country of 144 million people be effectively running out of workers?
Yeah, and the sources we've looked at, they paint this picture of a crisis that's so deep and now so accelerated that it's genuinely threatening the stability of the Russian economy, maybe even the state itself.
And the official economic numbers, they're deceptive too, aren't they?
Totally. By mid-2025, Russia's unemployment rate is reported to be staggeringly low, something like 2.2% or 2.3%.
Which, in almost any other industrial economy, you'd think, wow, that's fantastic. Full employment, booming growth.
Right. Cause for celebration. But here, it's the opposite. That low unemployment rate, it doesn't signal prosperity. It signals severe scarcity.
It means the labor market has just seized up. They've basically run out of people to hire.
Pretty much. Which leads to these critical shortages everywhere. Manufacturing, defense, healthcare, logistics. You name it.
So our mission in this deep dive, then, is to trace the roots of this, well, existential crisis. We need to go back, right? Back to the 90s.
Exactly. We'll start with that originating shockwave, the collapse of the Soviet Union. Then we'll look at how Russia's specific economic model, the petrostate structure, made its labor market rigid and vulnerable.
And finally, how the war in Ukraine acted as this brutal compounding accelerator, turning a slow decline into, well, a full-blown emergency.
Yeah, it's much more than just a tight job market. This is a deep demographic and structural crisis. It could fundamentally limit Russia's ability to, you know, project power, even maintain its own vast infrastructure, govern itself effectively for decades.
Okay. Let's start at the beginning then. Right, so to understand this famine today, we absolutely have to confront the 1990s, the collapse of the Soviet Union in 91. It wasn't just political, was it? It was like an economic and societal earthquake.
Oh, completely. Economic apocalypse is almost putting it mildly. The shift from communism to this chaotic, often criminal form of capitalism.
Yeah.
It was brutal. GDP just plummeted.
How much are we talking?
Around 40% between 1991 and 1998. Just think about that. It's steeper than the U.S. Great Depression, but crammed into just 8 years. Unbelievable speed.
And the social safety net people might have relied on.
Gone.
Yeah.
It just disintegrated. Privatization often meant asset stripping, not building competitive industries. Workers went unpaid for months sometimes. Mm-hmm. Unemployment officially hit 14%, but even that number, it doesn't capture the real pain. Mass underemployment, factories just shutting down.
And then there was the inflation.
Hyperinflation. It just vaporized people's life savings. The state treasury was effectively empty. So core services, pensions, public health care, education, they collapsed. The state just couldn't afford to care for its citizens anymore.
That must have created such a profound loss of faith in the future.
Exactly. And it was this immediate economic collapse that triggered what our sources call that devastating 1-2 punch on Russia's demographics. This is what locked in the current workforce shortage decades ago.
Okay, punch number one.
Fertility collapse. Simple as that. When people are terrified about the future, they stop having kids. Russia's fertility rate was 2.0 births per woman in 1989, almost replacement level. 2.1 is what you need.
And where did it go?
Crashed to a record low of 1.16 by 1999, barely half the replacement rate.
Wow, so in a decade, it halved. The implication of that.
It's huge. The sources say it clearly. An entire generation of children who should have been born simply did not exist. An entire cohort missing.
And you can't just magic those people back.
Exactly. That deficit is non-recoverable. This smaller group, born in the 90s, they're now in their prime reproductive years themselves. So there are far fewer potential parents today.
Even though the rate recovered a bit later?
It did, yeah. It crept back up to maybe 1.78 in the 2000s and 2010s.
Yeah.
But it's dropped again since. The fundamental damage was done. That demographic shock of the 90s created this permanently thinner base at the bottom of the population pyramid.
Okay, so that's the first punch. Fewer babies. What was the second?
The mortality spike. And this one is arguably even more tragic, more brutal. The sources suggest this collapse in male life expectancy. It was unprecedented in the developed world, unless you're talking about a full-scale war.
How bad did it get?
Male life expectancy was a decent 64 years in 1989. By 1994, just 5 years later, it had plummeted to 57.6 years.
Over 6 years lost in half a decade.
Yes. It's an immense statistical tragedy. And it meant millions of skilled working-age men were just permanently removed, gone from the labor pool, gone from their families.
What was killing them so suddenly, beyond just the general stress, which must have been immense?
The data points overwhelmingly to two things: social breakdown and alcohol. Cheap, often illicit, alcohol flooded the market just as social structures weakened.
How much are we talking?
By the mid-90s, annual consumption hit an average of 32 pints of pure alcohol per person. That's double the World Health Organization's crisis threshold. This wasn't just, you know, social drinking. This was despair and lethal doses.
And the impact wasn't just long-term health damage like liver failure.
No, it was immediate. An explosion in violent crime, horrific accidents and sudden heart issues, often brought on by binge drinking. There's this chilling statistic from 1995.
Yeah.
75% of homicide suspects arrested that year were detained while drunk. 75%.
Good grief. That paints a picture of utter chaos.
It does. It meant so many young men were lost not just to economic problems, but to premature, often violent deaths.
And with the government broke and public health collapsing, things like heart disease, other chronic conditions,
they just went untreated.
Exactly. The system couldn't cope at all. Mortality rates only really started to come back down, returning to pre-collapse levels well into the 2010s. So that demographic drain lasted nearly 20 years.
So fewer births, more deaths. This combination created that haunting term, the Russian cross.
That's right. It appeared on the demographic charts first in 1992. The line for deaths crossed above the line for births. That year, Russia recorded 1.8 million deaths, but only 1.6 million births. The population entered a state of natural decline. And it wasn't just a temporary blip.
No, not at all. That trend, deaths permanently exceeding births, it continued for 18 straight years. 18 years.
So by the time Vladimir Putin came to power and started stabilizing things, the demographic damage was already baked in.
Absolutely. The architecture of the future workforce shortage was already set in stone. The country had locked in a labor crisis that was bound to manifest. Well, right about now.
Which leads us straight to the aging population issue that was already a problem before the war. The population pyramid got totally skewed.
Oh, profoundly top-heavy.
Yeah.
Rostat data confirms it. Between 1990 and 2023, the share of Russians aged 65 and older went from 10% up to 16.6%. A huge jump.
And at the other end, the kids.
The future workforce children and teens under 16. their share shrank from 24% down to just 18.5%.
So what's the inevitable economic consequence of that kind of inverted pyramid?
Well, it's a self-feeding crisis, really.
Yeah.
First, you've got fewer young people entering the workforce each year, which inherently limits your production capacity.
Right.
Second, that older, larger group puts this massive, unsustainable burden on the pension system. A smaller and smaller group of working people is paying taxes and contributions to support an ever larger group of retirees.
So even without any external shocks, Russia was heading for a major financial pressure point and a labor crunch.
Guaranteed. The demographic time bomb was armed decades ago. It was just waiting.
Okay, so that structural weakness, that demographic hole, was dug back in the 90s. But now we need to look at how Russia's chosen economic path over the last couple of decades. It didn't fix the problem. In fact, it sort of locked the labor market into this state of chronic vulnerability.
Yeah, this is where it gets really interesting. This is the Petrostate paradox.
After the absolute chaos of the Yeltsin years, the strategy under Putin seemed pretty straightforward, right? Use the oil and gas money.
Exactly. Leverage Russia's immense natural resources to stabilize state finances, restore order, pay pensions, project power. And, you know, for a while it worked. Those energy revenues became the engine of stability.
But the reliance on it became almost total. We're talking about an economy just fundamentally hooked on volatile commodity prices.
Completely hooked. By the 2010s, energy exports were something like 2/3 of all export revenues. Mm. And they provided roughly half the federal budget. Half.
That massive cash flow basically insulated the state, didn't it?
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
They didn't have to do broader economic reforms.
Precisely. It allowed them to pay the pensions, maintain a huge public sector, buy social stability. But it came at a cost, a lack of labor market diversification.
Okay, help us understand the paradox here. If Russia was swimming in energy wealth, why didn't that translate into lots of good jobs across the economy?
Because oil and gas extraction. Hmm. They're capital-intensive industries, not labor-intensive ones.
Yeah.
Think about it. Huge investments in machinery, pipelines, complex technology, but relatively few actual workers needed on the ground to run it all.
How few people did it take to generate all that wealth?
The numbers are genuinely shocking. In 2020, the entire oil and gas sector, from drilling to export, employed only about 1.2 million workers.
1.2 million out of a workforce of what, 70-something million?
Yeah, it's barely 1.5% of Russia's entire workforce.
Yeah.
Yet that tiny slice generated 20% of GDP and provided 40% of government revenue.
So 98.5% of the workforce was essentially living off the spillover from this tiny, highly automated sector.
Pretty much. The employment wasn't direct in energy. It was indirect, fueled by government spending of those energy profits.
Paying for what? Bureaucrats.
A vast state bureaucracy, yes. Lots of public sector jobs and state-subsidized industries, military spending, pensions. These jobs offered stability, which was psychologically huge after the 90s, but they were generally low-paying, often inefficient.
And this created what you called labor market rigidity, because the real wealth was trapped in that tiny energy sector.
The other crucial civilian industries got starved. Manufacturing, high tech, services, retail, they couldn't compete for talent or investment.
They couldn't match the wages.
Not even close. Why would a top engineer or a sharp manager go work for some struggling manufacturing plant when they could get a much higher salary in the energy sector, or at least a very stable, if unexciting, public sector job funded by that oil money?
So the civilian sectors just never really developed properly.
They never matured. They didn't develop the innovation, the competitiveness they needed to sustain the economy if or when oil prices fell or something else went wrong.
And then you layer on top of that structural flaw the sheer geographic challenge Russia faces. The country is just massive.
Staggeringly large. And the wealth is concentrated in these incredibly remote, harsh regions, mostly Western Siberia, the Far East. But where does most of the population live?
Thousands of miles away in European Russia, Moscow, St. Petersburg.
Exactly. Over 70% of the population is clustered there. So those few high-paying energy jobs that do exist, they're physically inaccessible to most Russians unless they're willing to relocate to somewhere pretty grim and isolated.
What does that distance mean for actually running the country from Moscow?
Huge logistical headaches. To maintain the centralized control that the petrostate model demands, Moscow has to pour enormous resources, money, equipment, people just into keeping the basic infrastructure working across that vast territory.
And when the labor pool starts shrinking?
Those remote regions are the first to feel the pinch. Roads need fixing, pipelines need maintaining, local services need staffing, but finding workers willing to move to an Arctic outpost, even for good pay, it becomes nearly impossible, especially when wages in the big cities are also relatively high.
So the petrostate structure, it sounds like it created this kind of gilded cage. Huge revenues, but concentrated in a tiny part of the economy, failing to spur broad growth.
And relying on this centralized bureaucracy that was already straining under the demographic weight before the current crisis hit.
The vulnerability was structural. It was baked in. When the demographic losses from the 90s finally started showing up as serious worker shortages in the 2020s.
Russia just lacked the diverse, dynamic economic sectors that could adapt, innovate, or attract enough labor, domestic or foreign. It was fundamentally a crisis waiting for a spark.
And that spark, inevitably, was the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. So if the 90s dug the demographic hole and the petrostate model stopped it from being filled, the war became this brutal process that just actively started consuming what was left of the labor pool.
Consuming it from three directions at once. That's why we're calling it the triple drain. It turned a chronic, decades-long problem into an acute existential emergency almost overnight.
And the economy was already stretched thin before the invasion, right? Labor was already tight.
Absolutely. It was running near full capacity, with severe labor tightness already reported in many sectors. So every single person removed from the workforce after February 2022 had an immediate magnified impact.
Okay, let's break down the drains. Drain number one, military mobilization and manpower.
Right. The initial invasion force was around 190,000 professional soldiers. But sustaining that kind of high-intensity warfare, especially with heavy casualties, meant they needed more bodies, fast.
Which led to the mobilization in September 2022.
The partial mobilization, yes. Officially, they called up 300,000 reservists. But the real impact on the labor force was much bigger.
How much bigger?
Well, the sources suggest that by the end of 2022 alone, you're looking at an estimated 490,000 men pulled out of the civilian economy. That includes the formal mobilization, plus new contract soldiers signing up, plus those in the initial invasion force, nearly 500,000 men in less than a year.
And the critical thing here, the sort of circular damage, is where these men were pulled from.
Oh, it was a catastrophic self-inflicted wound, particularly for the war effort itself. Many of the mobilized men were skilled workers already employed in key industries.
Like defense manufacturing.
Exactly. Defense plants, complex logistics, specialized engineering roles. So just as the state was ordering these factories to ramp up production quotas to supply the army, they were simultaneously losing their most skilled, most experienced workers to the army.
Creating instant bottlenecks. You can't just train a specialized machinist overnight.
Not a chance. It immediately hit production quality and output. Just madness, really.
Okay, that's drain one. What's drain two?
Drain two, the exodus of the skilled. The brain drain. The threat of mobilization, especially after that September announcement, triggered this mass flight out of Russia, unprecedented in modern time.
How many people are we talking about leaving?
The conservative estimates put it between 700,000 and 900,000 Russians fleeing just in 2022. Some estimates are closer to a million.
A million people. Where did they go?
Mostly to former Soviet states. Initially, Kazakhstan, Armenia, Georgia were big ones. Also Turkey, Serbia, Dubai. Anywhere they could get to quickly to escape the draft and for some political persecution.
And what's really devastating for Russia's future here is the type of people who left. It wasn't just a random sample.
Not even close. The data is stark. Get this, 81% of those who fled right after the mobilization had a university degree. 81%.
Compared to what in the general population?
Only about 27% of Russians overall have a university degree. So hugely skewed towards the highly educated.
And they were young too.
Yeah, average age was 32. Right, in their prime productivity years, prime family forming years. Compare that to the national average age of 46. Russia lost its future in many ways.
That's a demographic gut punch. Which sectors were hit hardest by this brain drain?
The IT sector was absolutely decimated. Sources estimate between 100,000 and 170,000 IT workers left. That could be up to 20% of their entire IT workforce gone.
20%. That's not just losing people who build websites. That's critical infrastructure stuff, right?
Absolutely. These are the people essential for cybersecurity, for industrial automation, for maintaining the complex software systems that run everything from banking to the power grid to logistics.
So if 20% of your IT maintenance crew suddenly relocates to Yerevan or Dubai,
your internal digital infrastructure becomes incredibly vulnerable. You're relying on older systems, less secure systems. It cripples any chance of modernizing the economy, of moving away from just being a petrostate. It's a massive long-term blow.
Okay, mobilization, exodus. What's drain three?
Drain three, casualties and the state burden. This is most tragic, obviously. The permanent removal of working age people from the equation.
The human cost must be staggering by now.
It continues to climb dramatically. By mid-2025, total Russian casualties, and this includes the dead and the severely wounded who likely won't return to the workforce, are believed to have surpassed 1 million.
1 million. And the number killed.
Conservative estimates put the number of deaths somewhere between 200,000 to 300,000. These are overwhelmingly men, mostly young men, in their prime working and family starting years. Their loss is irreversible for the economy and society.
And the economic loss isn't just the lost productivity of those killed, right? The wounded create a whole other problem.
It's a huge hidden cost. Yeah. You have potentially hundreds of thousands of severely wounded soldiers who need immediate, expensive, and long-term state support. We're talking years of therapy, rehabilitation, prosthetic limbs, and crucially, early state pensions.
Which puts even more pressure on the already creaking social budget and the shrinking pool of active workers paying into the system.
Exactly. It drastically accelerates that pension crisis we talked about from the 90s demographic hole. It's another vicious cycle.
So this triple drain mode.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials, like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Mobilization, removing workers, the skilled fleeing, and casualties permanently deleting others. It all comes together in today's labor figures.
That's why that 2.2% unemployment rate isn't good news. It's a sign of absolute exhaustion. The system has run out of slack. Regions across the country are reporting critical shortages.
Like how bad?
We've seen reports from major industrial regions citing 9 job vacancies for every single registered unemployed person. 9 vacancies per person. Businesses literally cannot find people. They can't expand. They can't modernize. Sometimes they can't even maintain current operations.
And the long-term damage, the impact on future population growth?
Yeah.
It's already showing up.
Terrifyingly fast. The birth rate data for 2024 is just appalling. Only 1.22 million babies born in Russia.
How does that compare historically?
It's barely above the absolute record low seen back in 1999, 1.21 million during the very worst of the post-Soviet collapse.
So in just 3 years, the war has basically wiped out 2 decades of slow, painful demographic stabilization efforts.
Pretty much. It's thrown the country's reproductive health right back to the chaos and fear of the 90s. The long-term consequences are just immense.
Okay, so the labor pool is vanishing. The pressure is immense. How has the state reacted? It seems like they've essentially turned the entire economy towards the war effort.
That's exactly what's happened. They've weaponized the economy, but it's consuming what's left of the civilian sector. The first big pressure point is just raw state spending.
On defense.
Overwhelmingly. By 2025, defense and security spending had just exploded. It's over 40% of the entire federal budget now. Constituting almost 8% of GDP. That's a massive reallocation of resources. Russia is fully on a wartime economic footing.
And that level of spending must create this brutal competition for the few workers left, a military bidding war for labor.
Precisely. The military desperately needs soldiers for the front lines. The defense factories desperately need mechanics, engineers, technicians to build the equipment. They're fighting over the same shrinking group of working-age men.
And the state can't just order another mass mobilization easily, politically speaking.
Right. So instead, they've resorted to throwing money at the problem, unprecedented financial incentives for men to sign military contracts.
And these incentives, they just completely distort the civilian job market, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. They create this staggering economic pull. Contract soldiers can earn 3, 4, even 5 times the average Russian wage.
5 times.
Plus, the sign-up bonuses are enormous. Up to 1.9 million rubles, that's roughly $22,000 US, just for signing a 12-month contract.
$22,000 up front. For many people outside Moscow or St. Petersburg, that must be...
years of salary. For many Russians, that bonus represents 2, maybe even 3 years' worth of their normal income, paid immediately, tax-free.
So if you're working in a struggling civilian factory, wages are stagnant because of sanctions and inflation, and the army offers you that kind of money.
It's an almost impossible offer to refuse for many. The military becomes the highest paying, most reliable employer around. The civilian sector simply cannot compete.
Which just strips the civilian economy bare.
Exactly. Manufacturing, construction, retail, services. They're left with older workers, women, the least skilled. It just accelerates the collapse of the non-military industrial base.
And this collapse is made even worse by what the sources call the paradox of state control. The state is demanding more from defense contractors, but actually making it harder for them financially.
It's perverse. The state dictates the prices for military orders, and often those prices are set too low. They don't cover the contractor's full operational costs, let alone allow for profit or investment.
And they can't refuse the orders.
Not anymore. New laws make it a criminal offense for contractors to refuse a military order or fail to deliver on time. You could go to prison.
So, business owners are trapped. Produce for the war at a loss or risk jail. What does that do long term?
It destroys the industrial base from within. Factory owners are forced to cut corners, use subpar materials, cannibalize existing machinery, defer vital maintenance, anything to meet the quota and stay out of trouble.
So they can't invest in the future, like automation, which they desperately need because of the labor shortage.
No chance. All their capital, all their focus is tied up in just surviving these low-margin state-mandated orders. So the industrial base might be churning out tanks today, but it's essentially rotting internally.
Which all feeds into this vicious cycle of decline you mentioned.
Right. Less civilian production means lower tax revenues for the state. The state needs money for the military, so it cuts civilian spending, even further healthcare, infrastructure, social programs.
Making life harder for ordinary Russians, especially outside the big cities.
Exactly. Inflation is high, interest rates are brutal, people's prospects diminish, which, perversely, pushes them back towards the military as the only reliable source of a decent income. The whole economy is eating its own future to feed the war machine today.
Okay, so internal solutions are failing. What about the traditional safety valve, immigration?
Yeah.
Russia historically relied heavily on workers from Central Asia.
They did. Before 2022, there were about 5 million Central Asian migrants in Russia, mostly from Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan. They were absolutely essential for low-skilled jobs, construction, agriculture, cleaning, delivery services. It was a system that worked, more or less, even if it was often exploitative.
And economically vital for the migrants' home countries, too, right? The money they sent back.
Hugely important. Remittances often made up a massive chunk of their national economies. Like 50% of Tajikistan's entire GDP came from money sent home by workers in Russia.
But the war just completely broke that system. Why did it unravel so fast?
Three main reasons, really. First, simple economics. The ruble tanked after the invasion and sanctions hit. Wages that looked okay in 2021 suddenly weren't worth nearly as much in dollars or euros by 2023 or 2024. The real value of the money they could send home was slashed.
Okay, money's less attractive. What was the second factor?
Safety. Personal safety. This became huge after 2022. The threat of mobilization or being pressured or tricked into signing military contracts became very real.
Even though technically they weren't supposed to be drafted.
Technically, no. But reports flooded Central Asian communities about police harassment, random document checks turning into recruitment pitches, threats of deportation unless they signed up. Russia just stopped feeling safe, especially for young men. Parents became afraid to send their sons.
And the third reason it failed.
New opportunities opened up elsewhere. The world didn't stand still. Global competition for labor actually increased.
Where were they going instead?
Kazakhstan saw a boom as Western companies relocated there from Russia, creating jobs. The Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, UAE, launched massive construction projects and actively recruited Central Asian workers, often offering better conditions. Turkey, South Korea also expanded their labor programs. Migrants suddenly had other, safer, often better paying options. The risk of going to Russia just wasn't worth it anymore.
And we see this in the migration numbers, a real collapse.
Yeah, the data is striking. Kazakhstan reported a 20% drop in migrants heading to Russia in 2024. More recently, data from March 2025 showed a staggering 75% year-over-year drop in new labor migrants entering Russia. 75%.
So the main source of low-skilled labor is just drying up, precisely when Russia needs construction workers and logistics staff more than ever because of the war effort and the internal shortages.
Exactly. But here's the other thing. Even if migrants were still pouring in, they couldn't solve Russia's core problem. There are these fundamental structural barriers.
Okay, barrier number one.
They're the wrong workers for the biggest gaps. Russia is desperate for the highly skilled people who fled and drained too. The engineers, the IT specialists, the experienced technicians. Central Asian migrants typically fill low-skilled roles. You simply cannot replace a lost software architect with a construction worker. The skills don't match the need.
Makes sense. Barrier number two.
Russia's own deep-seated societal issue. Pervasive xenophobia and the failure of integration.
It's not a welcoming environment.
The sources are really clear on this. Central Asian migrants face constant systemic discrimination in finding housing, opening bank accounts, dealing with bureaucracy, police profiling, document checks, harassment. Mm-hmm. It's routine. It's aggressive.
Which discourages them from staying long term.
Absolutely. It makes permanent settlement, bringing families over, putting down roots. It makes it incredibly difficult and unpleasant. So they remain a temporary transient labor force, not a solution to the long term population decline.
And barrier number three goes back to geography again.
Yep, the geographic mismatch strikes again. Migrants naturally cluster where the most jobs are, which means the big cities, Moscow, St. Petersburg, mostly in the service sector.
But the worst labor shortages, the critical industrial ones.
They're out in the remote, harsh regions. Siberian oil fields, Arctic ports, far eastern military bases, and factories. These are precisely the places migrants tend to avoid if they can. So the most essential jobs, the ones underpinning the resource extraction and military maintenance, they remain unfilled.
So the military bidding war isn't sustainable. Immigration is failing. What else has the government tried? They tried to legislate more babies, didn't they?
Yes. The pronatal policies. With the birth rate currently scraping the bottom globally around 8.4 births per 1,000 people.
They passed a law, right? Banning, what was it, child-free propaganda?
Pretty much. The Duma passed legislation banning pernicious propaganda for a child-free way of life. The idea is to impose fines, maybe even jail time, for promoting a child-free existence online or anywhere else.
The official line being that it's decadent Western ideas causing the low birth rate.
That's the narrative, that it's somehow influencing young women against their natural patriotic duty to have children.
Okay, but let's apply some critical thinking here. Does banning a few social media groups about, I don't know, child-free travel actually stand a chance against the brutal economic reality Russians are facing?
It seems, well, absurd. The legislative effort looks particularly stark when you put it next to the economic picture. While the government is trying to outlaw child-free thoughts, the Bank of Russia has had to hike interest rates up to 21%. 21%.
To fight inflation. Which means mortgages.
Mortgages are likely over 20%, maybe closer to 25% in reality for most people. Think about buying a family apartment with that kind of rate.
It's impossible for most young couples.
Exactly. When young people face that reality savings eroded by inflation, huge job uncertainty because of the war, housing costs driven out of reach by insane interest rates, they're not going to choose to have children, regardless of same propaganda or bans on websites.
The basic confidence in the future just isn't there.
It's absent. As one analyst put it, you can't legislate fertility when the economic climate actively punishes family formation. This policy is symbolic at best, utterly doomed to fail at actually boosting births. It just underlines the state's inability or unwillingness to tackle the real structural causes of the crisis.
Which brings us, finally, to this, the stunning ultimate irony. The sources we looked at strongly suggest that a key motivation, maybe even a primary one, behind the invasion of Ukraine in the first place was actually a desperate, cynical attempt to fix Russia's own demographic problem, to acquire people.
It sounds grim, but from the Kremlin's strategic perspective, pre-war Ukraine looked like the perfect solution to their demographic hole.
How so?
Well, before 2022, Ukraine had a population of, say, 41 to 45 million people. Crucially, it was younger on average than Russia's population, had a slightly higher birth rate back then, and possessed this large pool of highly educated technical workers, engineers, people skilled in industries Russia needed.
And critically, the cultural and linguistic links were very strong.
It's exactly. Ukrainians represented, as one source put it, the most compatible source of immigrant labor Russia could ever hope for. If Russia could have successfully absorbed Ukraine, or even large parts of it.
It could have meant millions of new, relatively young, skilled workers pouring into the Russian system.
Potentially stabilizing Russia's economy and demographics for decades. It would have been a massive demographic windfall.
And there was evidence they planned for this. It wasn't just about territory.
There's strong circumstantial evidence. Think about how quickly they started handing out Russian passports in occupied areas like the Donbas, even before 2022. And the early administrative plan seemed focused on integrating Ukrainian regions directly into Russia's system, absorbing the population. They clearly saw the people, not just the land, as a key strategic prize to offset their own decades of decline.
But the war achieved the exact opposite, a complete strategic backfire on the demographic front.
Total backfire. Instead of gaining people, the war triggered a massive demographic catastrophe, arguably worse in Ukraine than in Russia, and strengthened Ukrainian national identity in a way that makes integration impossible.
What are the population numbers for Ukraine now?
Pre-war, estimates were around 43 million, give or take, today. Estimates range wildly, but generally fall between 31 and 35 million currently living within Ukraine's controlled borders. That's a potential loss of over 10 million people in just 3 years, mostly through displacement. Utterly devastating.
And where did the displaced people go, the refugees?
Over 6 million Ukrainians registered as refugees, mainly in Europe. Poland, Germany, Czech Republic took huge numbers. And these aren't temporary camps for the most part.
They're settling in.
They are. Families are integrating. Kids are in local schools. Adults are finding jobs, building new lives. They're establishing roots.
Which means, for Russia's strategic calculation, they're gone. Permanently lost.
Every single one of those individuals, those families, represents a permanent loss that Russia can now never claim, no matter how the war ends territorially. They sought to gain millions, and instead ensured millions were pushed permanently out of reach.
And tragically, the war has also wrecked Ukraine's internal demographics too, mirroring Russia's own losses.
Absolutely. Huge numbers of Ukrainian men killed or severely wounded, removed from the workforce and family formation. The demographic devastation has been mutual in that horrific sense.
But the final nail in the coffin for Russia's hope of gaining a vibrant population is what's happened to the birth rate inside Ukraine now.
It's plummeted even further.
Yeah.
Ukraine's fertility rate was already low before the war, maybe 1.2 now. It's estimated to have dropped by 30, maybe 40% in some regions. It's fallen below 1.0 nationally, record lows.
So even if Russia somehow conquered all of Ukraine tomorrow, the demographic prize they invaded for is gone.
It's gone. The future population structure of Ukraine is now destined to be far smaller, older, and deeply scarred by this conflict. The vibrant workforce Russia perhaps hoped to annex simply doesn't exist in the same way anymore.
This whole narrative, it just perfectly illustrates that phrase, a self-perpetuating disaster.
It really does. Russia starts a war, partly driven by a need for more people. But the act of fighting kills its own young men, drives away its existing skilled workers, and demolishes the population structure of the very nation it wanted to absorb.
Every action taken to solve the demographic problem through force has only made the problem exponentially worse for everyone involved.
It's a profound strategic failure, layered on top of the initial demographic weaknesses. The attempt to gain demographic strength has only accelerated Russia's own decline, locking it into a much deeper crisis that will take generations to maybe possibly reverse. If it even can be reversed. #tagoutro.
So wrapping this up, this deep dive really shows that Russia's personnel famine. It isn't some temporary blip in the labor market. It's structural, it's long-term, and it's compounding.
Yeah, it was seeded way back by that mortality spike and fertility collapse in the 90s. Then it was sort of hardened into place by the rigidity of the petrostate economy. And now it's been brutally accelerated by the triple demographic drain of this war.
And the usual fixes for demographic problems, they just seem completely unavailable or ineffective for Russia right now.
Right. You can't just magically fix a fertility rate of 1.5 overnight. Having more babies takes decades to impact the workforce. And besides, the current economic reality, those 20% mortgage rates, makes starting a family incredibly difficult, almost prohibitive for many.
And immigration.
That's failed too. The combination of the falling ruble, the very real safety threats from mobilization and coercion, and just the pervasive xenophobia, it's dried up that vital flow of labor from Central Asia.
So the last resort might be automation, technology.
But that needs huge capital investment. It needs innovation. And critically, it needs the highly skilled technical workforce, the engineers, the IT specialists that Russia is rapidly losing through sanctions restricting access to tech and through the ongoing brain drain. They lack the money and the people to automate their way out of this.
So Russia still looks powerful on paper, doesn't it? It has the nuclear arsenal, the vast resources.
It does. But its actual capacity to convert those assets into real, political and economic influence, especially relative to faster-growing economies elsewhere. That capacity is diminishing rapidly as its productive workforce shrinks year after year.
And if we connect this whole crisis to the bigger picture, what's the final thought? The worker shortage makes it harder and harder for Moscow to just maintain the basics across that enormous territory.
That's the really critical point, I think. Imagine the sheer cost and manpower needed to keep the pipelines flowing, the roads passable in winter, the hospital staffed, the lights on across 11 time zones, all with a shrinking, aging workforce.
History has some ominous precedents there.
It does. We saw the Soviet Union collapse, driven largely by internal economic and structural weaknesses, not just external pressure. When a central government loses the ability to effectively manage its vast territory and provide basic stability because its core population is shrinking and its economy is faltering,
it creates openings.
It creates the conditions for regions to start looking after themselves, especially those far-flung resource regions that might feel Moscow is draining them without providing enough in return. Mm-hmm. It could push them towards demanding greater autonomy, maybe even challenging central control down the line if the center continues to weaken.
So the Russian demographic time bomb, it wasn't just ticking. It feels like it exploded in 2022.
And the economic and political aftershocks are likely to shape Russia and reverberate across the global stage for the rest of this decade and probably much longer.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.